Hey, welcome everyone for the weekly English medium discussion. We have about little more than 1 hour. So before starting the retreat, before starting the discussion, I'd like to know, we are dealing with Sutta Nipata. We are almost finished Attadanda Sutta. Before going to that particular Sutta, if someone is having any other things like interview reports or any other things,
yeah, I'd like to actually
starting a new one.
Start a new one. It felt to me like we should maybe just give a quick review back over the sutta again, because we go through it point by point. Sometimes we can lose the wood from the leaves from the forest. We can get lost in the leaves a little bit. And I just thought it was a very timely sutta for us to consider. So again, just to remind people that this is a sutta that the Buddha was giving between a conflict that was arising between a border dispute between the Koliyans and the Sakyans. And what's very astonishing is what the Buddha, what does the Buddha advise in this time of a conflict? Yeah, so what is the Buddha advising in the time of this kind of great conflict? What's he thinking about? Because it's very easy to get sucked into one side or the other side of a big conflict, whereas he actually just walks the line in between. And so that's why I thought it was quite interesting for us to put ourselves back into that time, into that situation, that there's a great war, a great conflict breaking out, and there's two armies about to go to battle and face death and injury. And what is the Buddha talking about in this time? Because it's a very strange sutta, because it's very radical. He doesn't actually even address... He doesn't exactly address the armies and tell them you're doing right, you're doing wrong. You know, he talks very personally about his own experience. So he says, fear arises from one who has taken up weapons. See the person engaged in strife. I will tell you of my sense of urgency, how I was stirred by a sense of urgency. So again, like, this is a situation that I feel at the moment. I feel a strong sense of urgency around these conflicts that are rising around the world when I hear them. Because, I think, what can I do about this? So here the Buddha says, like, seeing that strife, I will tell you about my own sense of urgency and how it has stirred up a sense of urgency. Having seen the population trembling like fish in a pool with little water, having seen them hostile to one another, fear came upon me. So it's true, you can see when civilian populations get surrounded by armies, you know, of course they're trembling and in great fear. And having seen the hostility towards one another, fear comes upon me. So fear is very natural to arise when we see a great threat or a danger. So we need to manage our fear, be informed by our fear, and take heed of the fear. So fear is going to be converted from something negative, like the urgency to run away, to wisdom, which is the seeing things as they really are. The world was insubstantial all around. All the directions were in turmoil. Desiring an abode for myself, I did not see any place unoccupied. So again, you can see when there's a great fear that there's a throng of the crowd and the mob, and we don't know our place in the world. We're swept away. So he's very accurate in how he's describing his own experience of this conflict and war. Sashi. Having seen those hostile at the end, discontent came upon me. Then I saw the dart here, hard to see, nested in the heart. So again, this idea of a dart is the two darts. One is of pain and the other is of suffering. And we can't do much about the dart of pain, but we can do something about the dart of suffering. And so he's going to look into instead of looking at the dart, the weapons in other people's hands, he's looking at the dart that is piercing his own heart, and he's going to examine it. When one is struck by that dart, one runs astray in all directions. But having drawn out that dart, one does not run, does not think. So here the problem and the solution is within oneself, within the fathom-long body. So when struck by that dart of fear, because we're all experienced by fear, even with the best of armor, we will still be struck by that dart of fear. So he says, having struck by that dart, but having drawn out that dart, one does not run, does not think. So here he's telling us to tackle our fear, to go to it, go down to the root cause of this fear and uproot that fear. There the trainings are recited. Whatever bonds there are in the world, one should not be intent on them. Having entirely pierced through sensual pleasures, one should train for one's own nibbana or extinguishment. So here he's telling us that we need to exercise a sila, exercise our virtue, because when we have great fear, we cast aside our law and order. We throw down, we have a special emergency rules that in this time of war, there's an exemption. And if I kill somebody else, I'm not really killing somebody else. I'm just defending myself. So in these times of great conflict, we need to really double down on our own morality. And that's when it's actually hard. You know, it's easy to say I keep precepts when I'm not threatened. My precepts are not threatened at all. But when I am threatened, that's when the real precepts are being challenged and kept. But we need precepts as a basis. Otherwise, we're just animals. One should be truthful, not imprudent, without hypocrisy, devoid of divisive speech, without anger. A muni, a spiritual person, should cross over the evil of greed and miserliness. So here he's just talking very quickly, going through a list of qualities of a true spiritual practitioners. So first he begins with truthfulness. So there's a great correlation between straightening the mind and straightening one's speech. So it's not, you know, you find again in war, there's the fog of war, where people just say rubbish things. You know, they're asked a question, they don't give the answer, they're not truthful. And he says here to be not imprudent. Imprudent means cautious. You know, you throw caution aside. You, instead of being cautious and thinking, like, why is this person attacking me? What's the basis? You just throw away that imprudence and you're just like callous. Without hypocrisy, a double standard. Oh, my life is important and the other person's life is not important. As a being, all beings cherish their own life, their welfare, their happiness. They have children too. Devoid of divisive speech. So divisive speech comes in all kinds of forms. Like, I can be, how can I be your friend? Can be divisive speech. You know, if you're your enemy's friend is your enemy. So when somebody is speaking sweetly and nicely, you have to be very careful. Is this a kind of form of divisive speech? It's easy to think of harsh speech as divisive, but there's sweet speech that's also very divisive. Without anger, a spiritual person should cross over the evil of greed and miserliness. So the most basic metric I have in my mind is, am I bending towards the object or am I bending away from the object? Like I always remember being quite insensitive when I was meditating, or just, you know, when you're in a very fine state of mind, you don't really know whether you're having greed or aversion. But like, I just view it as the mind is bending. So in the commentaries or in the analysis, the etymology of the word nama means to bend. That the mind is, that the purpose of the mind is to bend towards the object. It's that which bends. Rupa does not bend. So I look in my mind and I see, am I bending towards the object or am I deflecting away from the object? Whereas the purpose of wisdom is to stand as still as a post. One should vanquish sleeplessness, torpor, and dullness. One should not keep company with heedlessness. A person whose mind is set on extinguishment should not perish, should not persist in arrogance. So here it's a very interesting word, should not persist in arrogance. It means to be humble. You know, sometimes we have to think the opposite of what he's saying. It's like if you're really striving in the holy life, you'll always be humble with people. Like, they may have a different idea and understanding, and it can be astonishing where wisdom can pick up the necessary information for insight. So arrogance is a real impediment to learning. So try not to persist in arrogance. Try not to. We can feel so righteous when we're on the side of the good. You know, our side is right and the other side is wrong. And we should vanquish sleeplessness, torpor, and dullness. So these are kind of all avoidance strategies. You know, I see nothing, I see nothing, I see nothing. This war is, it's nothing to do with me. Okay, I'm sitting in a forest, why should I bother about it? But I can take that spiritual fear, that samvega, from it. One should not keep company with the heedless. Again, the heedless are people like, whereas, oh, it doesn't matter, it's all the same. You know, these people are just killing themselves, they're just animals. You know, this kind of indifference, callousness, heedless. You know, Nibbana, we need insight and wisdom to penetrate into the heart of darkness. So being heedless and lazy and all these other things are going to prevent you from seeing into the heart of darkness. And so will arrogance. One should not lead into false speech. One should not engender affection for form. One should fully understand conceit. One should refrain from rashness. So here he's getting into kind of character, into, you know, from the thought arises the habit, from the habit arises the character and the personality. So here, these are things you have to bend over a long period of time. One should again emphasizing again this false speech, truth. Truth is very aligned with insight and wisdom. One should not engender affection for form. So again, we shouldn't be distracted by beauty or ugliness or so on. We should just see things as they really are. One should fully understand conceit. Conceit is I am. I am better than you, I am the same as you, or I am equal to you. So again, he'll repeat this later on and tackle it in various ways, different aspects of conceitedness. One should refrain from rashness. Rashness is moving too quickly or not fully appraising the situation. So mindfulness is always that giving oneself that space for more information to arise or to step back a little bit. One should not delight in the old. One should not form a liking for the new. One should not sorrow over what is diminishing. One should not be attached to an attraction. So here, again, one is delighting in the old means you hang on to the past. One is not forming a liking for the new means you're trying to look into the future. So older people look to the past and younger people tend to look to the future. Or when you're sitting in meditation, when we have that reflection on the past, it's often out of remorse. And when we have thoughts about the future, it's often because of anxiety. So it's very immediate to our practice. One should not sorrow over what is diminishing. So sadness, the purpose of sadness is to process loss and change. So here, sorrowing over it means that you're indulging into it. So you're swept away by that feeling of sadness. Whereas if you have mastery over sadness, you're informed that things are being lost and changing. So one should not be attached to an attraction. So here again, everything is fleeting, and if we're attached to an attraction, then we're not seeing the big picture. We're not able to see that things happening in the wider world because we're fixated on one thing. I call greed the great flood. I call longing the rapids, the basis compulsion, the swamp of sensuality hard to overcome. So this idea of Olga, a great flood, a flood is in the Ganges, in the time of the Buddha, the Ganges River and all these other rivers were great forces of nature, and there would be floodings, and from that flooding would come the bounty that would irrigate the rivers. But on the other hand, there could be death. So this idea of a flood is very pregnant, an idea. And we have to think about it, like we're always swept away by sensuality. It's a flood in the modern times. We have a flood of information, technology. So we can be swept away by these things. The swamp of sensuality is hard to overcome. So news, you know, the news cycle, media, scrolling on phones and devices, like this is kind of like the swamp of sensuality, hard to overcome. Not deviating from truth, a spiritual practitioner, a Brahman, stands on high ground, having relinquished all, he is indeed called peaceful. So here again, if you remember that this war was because of a river changing the boundaries between two areas. So his metaphors and themes are reminding us of the situation, the setting of this conflict. And that, you know, the only high ground, the only safe place to stand in a flood is for the spiritual person is not deviating from truth. And having relinquished all, that means like you relinquish not your necessities or what is enough, but what you don't need. You know, you go back to an essential life. One who truly is a knower, having known the Dhamma, is independent, living rightly in the world, he does not long for anything here. So once you find this truth, which is only found within, then you are independent. You're not dependent on the world. Most people are dependent on their parents, dependent on their society. And most people who think they're independent are just provisionally independent. If circumstances change, then they're not independent at all. Whereas only the spiritual practitioner is truly has that opportunity to be truly independent, where they're interdependent. Actually, they're neither dependent nor independent. They're interdependent. One here who has crossed over sensual pleasures, the tie so hard to overcome in the world, who has cut off the stream without bonds, does not sorrow, does not hope. So here it's very interesting. He puts sorrow and hope together. So, you know, people think it's very binary. That's always an indication to me of a crazy person, that they see the world as black and white. They're either in sorrow or they're in hope. So it's actually neither sorrow nor hope. It's a middle way where one sees things as they really are. One has crossed over from sensual pleasures. So you don't derive great happiness from sensual pleasures. You derive it from meaning, from truth, from seeing the world as it really is. And so you cut off the stream of bonds, meaning things that will tie you down or things that will anchor you into your defilements. Dry up what pertains to the past. Let there be nothing afterward. If you do not grasp in the middle, you will live in peace. So here we have to try and not hang on to the past, not sort of get lost into fantasies about the future, and not grasp in the middle means not get stuck in the present moment either. Like that would be stuck into sensual pleasures. So if we use mindfulness to be here now, I am, then everything is momentarily arising and passing away. So we don't hang on to here now, I am, because that is not here now, I am. One who does not claim as mine anything at all here in name and form, who does not sorrow over what is non-existent, truly does not lose out in the world. So here he's digging deeper and deeper into this idea of conceit, because this is at the heart of wisdom and at the heart of insight, is this claim that there is a mine, especially of my own body, that there is a mine, a permanent self, a soul, something like that. But then mine can be, this is mine, my land, my territory, my side of the riverbank, and it's not yours. And even if the river moves and changes, then I'm saying it's still mine, even though now that land is on the other side of the river. You know, people can get into, they form this attachment or perception, national identity. I'm Irish. My team is the best team. And all of these kind of ideas. It's all around this sense of mine. So We attach it to name and to form. We can attach it to the land as mine, this body is mine, or these ideas are mine, this culture is mine, this language is mine. So we can put mine onto all kinds of aspects of name and form. Who does not sorrow over what is not existent? It doesn't exist. There is no mine. You know, you have to look very deeply into your experience of the world to realize that there is nothing that is mine. No name, no form is mine. That's something you have to experience directly. It's not an intellectual argument or it's not a philosophy. You have to know that nothing is mine. If it was mine, I can hang on to it. I can keep it. It's not the case. Everything I will lose. Everything will die. One who for whom nothing is taken as this is mine and this belongs to others, not finding anything to be taken as mine, does not sorrow, thinking it is not mine. So when we die, when we pass on, like the problem is that we're hanging on to this concept of mine, and that grasping is often what binds us to this rebirth. In the end, we are subject to aging, sickness and death, but the problem is birth. You know, everybody is talking about aging, sickness and death, but really the problem is birth. And like, why are we in trouble a lot of the time? Simply because we were born. You know, if you were born in Afghanistan, good luck. It's going to be tough. You know, you're born in Silicon Valley. Oh, you're not the smartest guy in the room. You just happen to be born in a bloody peaceful place and time where there's law and order and you can make a lot of money. You know, try making a lot of money in the middle of the Gobi Desert. You're not going to have a good go at it unless you find something uranium or something super spectacularly valuable. No, you know, so this is mine. Or this belongs to others, not finding anything to be taken as mine, does not sorrow. So this is the path out of suffering. We sorrow and sorrow and sorrow over what is mine and what is not mine. I want it, I don't want it. You know, and this is the problem, is within our own heart. So this is where we've come to in our sutta. We can go into the detailed analysis. But I just thought it would be worth giving a review today to understand this kind of crazy, crazy talk that the Buddha is given in the middle of a bloody war. What the hell is he on about? He didn't scold anybody. He didn't say, oh, you guys calm down and stop being a bunch of jerks. You know, we can all get along. We can all be pals. He's not talking about any of that. He's just saying, yeah, this is what happened when I had fear. This is what happened when I got terrified. This is what happened when I saw the mob, when I saw all the signs of death. In his case, the Buddha had to see old age, sickness and death, the signs that his family had protected him from seeing, before he, that visceral like repulsion or fear was like in his heart going like, oh my God, there's old people, there's dead people, there's sick people. I didn't know anything about this. So here again, we can take fear and turn it into wisdom and as an impetus to practice. So we're here in the forest. It's all nice, calm, quiet, peaceful, and stagnant in a way. Every now and again, you have to kind of feel that fear of like, oh, Jesus, you know, that's why I'm here, and this is why it's important, and this is meaningful, you know, and everybody else can get on with their damn war, but this is what's driving me. And so he gives an intensely personal, very deep, very personal, you know, you want to know the Buddha, read this sutta. He's telling you about himself. You know, this isn't some teacher talking about a curriculum. This is a very amazing person talking about what's driving him and how he deals with these really difficult situations. And he doesn't avoid them. He's in the middle of a conflict. He could be off in a forest, in a cave, and he's not. He's trying to talk a bit of sense into them, or at least give a teaching. And he did give a teaching. It's the one that's passed down through the times. So maybe a lot of people got killed and died on this day of this battle, but maybe a lot of people listened to this teaching and learned from it too. So we can learn from other people's mistakes and from their actions. You know, they've paid the price, but we took the essence from it. Anyway, these are some thoughts. Maybe I can listen to Mahatero. Will we go on to the next verse? Yeah, we haven't. We have the last three to do. Not bitter.
Okay, I would like to, as far as the comments are concerned, two remarks came to my mind. Mahasi Sado used to say, when there are disciples, when they are listening, I give advice. When there is no one is listening or there is no disciples, I advise myself. This is the answer.
mother's party, father's party, no one listen. Two times they listen, still they are about to fight. He is advising himself, how lucky I am. I had this kind of situation past. I was maintaining in the equilibrium. So he reminding his own equilibrium. And he advised himself, nice guy, you have done beforehand. Now this is the time, don't let them, don't tell them. There, no one is listening. Then he advised himself. So it was just a Mahasi Sayadaw's wise word. When there are people, I advise them. When they are listening. If they are not listening, I reflect myself and I advise myself. This is a great teacher. He says that, what the hell, these disciples are not listening to me. They are very arrogant and adamant. No, nothing. That you also have gone through this. And therefore, as far as there are people listening, you can be talkative and lip service you can do. But there are a lot of chances no one is listening. If there is no one or available people not listening, then you advise oneself. And the second thing came to my mind was, that when we are renouncing, I am from the normal village and parents and everyone is very happy. And they can't understand why I am renouncing. Because I kept that secret for 8 to 9 years. And then all of a sudden resign. And by that time my family members are married, gone away. Only my mother and myself was at home with one sister. So I decided, like a quick thing, and came here. And lucky enough, in 7 weeks' time, I got the opportunity to ordination. And there they were crying. They were telling that, what the hell, that you are a youngest brother. How can we lose you? By that time, they have already lost because they have gone family life. Then I thought, do I also anchor, harbor any kind of a loss? Not the family members are losing me. But I am also feeling it. I am not expressing it. I also feel sorry because I have come to a new place. I know nothing. And I had a kind of adventurous feeling, like a scouting. But they are so intimate. And they look after me in such an affectionate way. So do I also have kind of a lost, miss? Of course, but it is not the time to express it. Just harbor. And my one of the elder sisters, she was almost crying and about to burst. And the whole ground, Dharmayatana, was taken, crying like shouting. And usually my affection was basically with the mother. Mother found she can't cry. If she cries, the sister will be completely out of control. So I feel mother is in a grip. And she came and she offered the first dana to my first new bowl. And mother's best friend, the village lady, she came and offered me a handkerchief. And everything is happening in a very emotional way. And the sister is crying, crying, crying. Godwin came and told me, Mante, you have to do something. She is about to crack. Then, no, don't tackle it. Don't tackle it. Let she cry to finish. And next, Godwin came. And then, message came to the mother. When the Godwin come, Godwin, you know Godwin, that from the Nilambe? He was our teacher, he knows. And when he comes, I allow him to come. When mother comes, I went down. I don't allow her to come. At the first shy. Then she says that God didn't become a big fellow. He is allowed to come in. And when we family members are coming, we are not allowed. And the second time, third time, only mother came 3 times before her passing away. She came to my kuti number 6. And she was, at that time, she accepted me as a monk. And sitting in the inner walking path, asked Bante, she is calling me not the son now. Bante, do you know how to walk the walking path? Walking meditation? Then I asked, did you come here to teach me walking meditation? Mind your own business. And then the mother's friend says, Bante, don't tell like that. This is your mother. I am asking her to mind her own business. Is she the one to tell me how to walk, do the walking? Because it was a completely new thing for my mother. They have never seen a walking path, even the born Buddhist and kind of thing. And she says, I am so happy you became a monk and you are doing walking meditation. And she wanted to share her feelings. Do you know how to do walking meditation? She was sitting in an inner walking meditation and she saw outer walking meditation. Then I thought, okay, I can make it, don't worry. And she almost crying and told, this may be the last time I am seeing you. And we gave the commemoration dana for our deceased father. And the village temple monk told, stop it, that uncle was doing enough merits, you have nothing to do, and mind your own business, like. And she told, this is the last time I am going to give a dana for father, my father, and I will not come. Then I told, you had 11 children, one died, 9 married, I am ordained. Now it's a time for you to go. All the people came and asked him, Banti, what are you talking about? Or to tell something affectionate. Then I told, no. She came and she says she's about to die. Of course, that was the truth. Passed away. And we have feelings. When I see the corpse, I went with a prepared mind because Venerable Jnananda was with me. He told that I may burst. He told not only that, you have to give a first sermon also to the relatives. And he gave me a topic and he gave me some things. Sabbe Sankara Anicca, how to give a sermon. So I went there and I tried my best not to cry. But given a seat just in front of my mother's corpse, and she was fully decorated as a upcountry old lady, and she was just doing meditating life. So I made in, but her best friend was there, and she was so unhappy. She was leaning to the wall and told, I just wanted to ask, your friend went earlier, no? Then I burst. When I'm telling, didn't you, the friend went early, isn't it? Then I thought, better not to talk. When I'm going to talk, I can feel the urge is coming. And then the elder brother came. And he was such an adamant person. He's a communist. And when he was coming, he has nothing to tell me. I have nothing to tell him, because if I am going to talk, whatever may be, I know I can't maintain it. And no, I do. I am shy to say I am unhappy. Because I am a meditator. So I was hiding it, but I feel it. I feel it because my mother. So when I come, I was fairly okay. Then Loko Amdaru told, I also mentally participating in a funeral. There's no death notice. There's no inner decorations. Just a simple way, full of people coming and finished. So what I'm telling is, even when we are renouncing, even when we are going, just like our family members, we have. But just like the Buddha, he reflect himself, but never going to tell them, because useless. They are in a completely other world. Mother's family is about to fight with the father's family. So Buddha, this is talking about the Buddha. He is the best peacemaker. 2 times yes, 3rd time no. So therefore we monks, when we are practicing, we have same feelings. He attributed 2 things, the fear and suffering, or fear and doubt. You have the fear of doubt and the suffering of the doubt. Or we can say fear, or instead of this thing, we can say the suffering. We can see the fear. And because of the pain. By four, pain, either suffering or fear. So even the Buddha is having it, but he is expressing to us rather than his mother and father's clan. He is communicating with us. I myself reflected beforehand. I have gone through these kind of things. So I am prepared. So I am making use of it. I am not going to ask them to be calm and peaceful and kind of thing. Just wait. So when we go to Satipatthana, sometimes children completely uncontrollable. So then I just wait and see what the organizers are going to do. Sometimes they are going to hit the children. When you go to Polonnaruwa, 3,000 children. We were doing with the teachers and the directors. Minister also came. And the Tara, the secretary also with us. And the principal came. Bande, can you do little bit to the children? Then I told, if it is so, prefects and the whole the staff must be in the morning session. Evening I will take. Tara told, don't take it, Bante. It is not a joke. Don't take it. Then I told, coming from here to the Polonnaruwa, I will take 1,500 girls and 1,500 boys. And one scouting master with a stick. He took a walk around the school. There is no other place to walk. And boys are playing hell. He is having a stick and whack the fellows. This is walking meditation. Don't talk. So I was thinking, what a joke. When we are coming, all the 1,500 girls within the premises, they have sit. Boys are not sitting. They are shouting and the place is so dirty. And they asked me to conduct 5 minutes sitting meditation. They are not ready. Then Darshana came, he told, you see that your sisters, they are calm and quiet sitting. You people together with the prefects, together with the teachers, you are not sitting. Because they are kind of a protest. Then he said, I will ask girl prefects to come and calm down you. Please. Now Bhante is going to talk. And before that, the principal talk. Principal talk, whatever we are going to do, there are some culprits, they are always making trouble, I know. Then I told, again they become agitated. Then, third minute, Australia, the bird sitting on the old oak tree and kookaburra sound came. We are sitting in a mango grove. And boys also sitting. Calm down happened, the kookaburra sound came. And the third, fourth minute again sound, fifth minute chaotic. Then I told him, I am so happy, at least in the third minute, we can feel the breeze, we can feel the kookaburra sound, and that's the end of the session. And they are very difficult. Because their mood is completely, but the girls completely different. But the boys, they feel it is not, the meditation is not the boys' job. It's a girl's job. We are to shout. Even the staff members are there. They are with a stick. Even the principal comes. Listen. So what to do? And everyone is looking at my face. Am I distracted? Of course distracted. What to do? And the girls are, they're calm and quiet like the statues. So you have to understand how much you have been a troublemaker in a place. How much you have been a peacemaker in that place. Now just remember that. And sometimes you yourself is a culprit. Sometimes you yourself is a peacemaker. And now these three are about to fight. You see, the Third World War is about to crack. And what the hell we can do? Not that we don't have feelings, not that we don't have the doubt, not that we have the fear, not that we are not suffering, we are not having, but we remember they are the reflection of the past. It is not the character of sati. Sati is be here and now, unmoved, but I am moved. Because in front of me, a bloodshed going to happen, and I am the pivot, I am the Buddha. I am the peacemaker. So, mind your own business. Be mindful, mind your own business. If no one is listening, advise to yourself. These two remarks I would like to share. As a long life of my monk's life, half of my life is lay, very, very active. Party positive, trip going, and monitor, and the prefects, all the kind of thing. And as a monk, About 20 years I am a junior monk. And about now 1996 onward, I am now advising and meditation master, so to say. But I feel again a young culprit, the troublemaker, still living within me. Yesterday I postponed the trip here and completely prepared the pond we have prepared and completely half done the second cave we have done. And the frame for the pyramid prepared, I had no chance, and raining, and water level gone up. We were finishing 8 o'clock in the evening. We thought of coming at 9 o'clock morning. Then Chandratnamdu told, never mind, Bandi. There's a retreat I will tackle today. Please come tonight at least. When you're coming here at 10 o'clock, whole body is painful. It's a complete treatment. And water, mud, rock, and electric posts. So I feel that the young, robust man, he needs, he feel it. And when the people are working like hell, I think that I am also the same. But it is, I have no feeling, this is me and me. I mean, not that completely gone. This is there. So people think, no, ordained people are enlightened people. They must not do this kind of a soil work. They must not do firewood collection. No, we did everything. We have the same doubt, same fear, same suffering. But reflect back, now they are slowly going, and we are doing at least, of course, for the sake of hobby. Doing for the sake of doing, hobby, but not expecting all the time the winning and the success and kind of thing. And when the failure happened, we were lifting an electric post from here to there, that end was fixed. This one, we had to raise it and sit on the fence post. Four times fallen down. This time, river, water, this thing, this time, edge. Four monks, and there were four people also. So at eight o'clock, we just got it, this thing, and put little concrete and came back. So when I go to next time, we don't know. Sometimes it may be fallen down. Sometimes some person would have with the rainbows. So it is. No one is telling we must not seek for success. But 7 o'clock we decide to stop, halfway. Fallen down. And again, fallen down, debris were there. And upon that, we were we don't have a knife. We don't have a saw. We don't have a crowbar. Everything was taken from the right round. And they were there in the stores. No one is going there because we were playing. So I thought that, what the monkhood? Are you a monk? No one allowed to come. We are in the edge of the forest. And that is the way it is. It is, of course, grimful and suffering kind of thing. What I am talking about is a happy thing. And we would have broken our neck. That's all I have. Two remarks. Sudhamsu? Anyone? I am telling that even the monks, we are human. Don't put us into a different category. Sometimes we are standing on ceremonies. We know. That's a joke. That's just a play. But most of the time we are human. In the forest, we can just fly. But imagine, think about the village monk. Whole day standing on ceremonies. All the blames about the monks goes to him. And we get the best phrase and the best treatments and telling we are calm and quiet. No, we are not calm. We are not quiet. When we get the chance, we are ready to do manhandling, physical work. So this is a kind of, not the physical, but the Buddha remembering as a, before becoming a Buddha, how much he has taken up, and he is putting them into practice now. Now, about to get blood bath. So I take conspiracy theory. He is always against me. But we are always talking about the nonsense. World affairs. Okay?
More you understand yourself, better you understand the others.
So that means placebo. Everything is nothing but placebo. If you believe it's a success, it's a success. If you think it's a failure, medical science, astrology, this Ayurveda, all are placebo. Once the mind is set, everything is okay. Till that, you have to go for black magics, you have to go for medical, you have to go for Ayurveda, all the kind of thing. Do it. Mind you, one day, you will develop this mental power and Manopubhangama Dhamma Manosetta Manomaya. The book written for that is placebo effect. You are the doctor, you are the patient, you are the medicine. 20 minutes more. We'll go to the next verse, Bhante.
So the last three, the first is not bitter, not greedy, without impulse, everywhere the same. When asked about one who is unshakable, I call that the benefit. So that's really beautiful. So this idea of being unshakable is seeing things as they really are. You know, normally when we see tragedy, when we see great wealth or great attractiveness, when we're shaken, we bend towards or we deflect away from the object. We're repulsed by the object or we're attracted to the object. If we're repulsed by the object, we deflect, we bend away. When we like the object, we bend towards it. So to be unshakable, it doesn't mean numb, indifferent, callous, ignorant. It means seeing things as they really are. And not bitter. The taste of medicine is bitterness. I always remember one of my teacher monks saying to me, always eat a little of the bitter. You know, when you have the food, we have a big buffet here. Don't be avoiding the bitter taste. Whenever I eat American food, I'm always surprised they take the bitterness out of the food. American food has no bitterness in it. But this Burmese teacher would always tell me, oh, take some of the bitter, because it's the taste of medicine. But when we are practicing, when we are feeling, when we suffer in the practice, when dukkha is arising, it has a bitter quality. And dukkha can really sit on your shoulders hard. You know, that sustained practice, you get oppressed by dukkha itself. And there's a natural bitterness. So sometimes you have to go and look at the sun. Sometimes you have to look at the moon. Sometimes you have to look at the sunset. Sometimes you have to look at the Buddha Rupa to kind of warm up the heart and not feel bitter. So we have to balance our practice to not be bitter, because if you're eating medicine all the time, it can be a bit bitter. Not greedy is like sometimes, again, like practitioners of samatha and stuff like that, they're like, oh, I just love peace. I just like calm, quiet, nobody disturb me, everything is great, you know, and they're like, it's greedy. You know, the world is not like this little glass house. And so don't be harsh on the one side, don't be indulgent on the other side. And, you know, don't be, you know, your practice is too real or it's too calm and peaceful. So without impulse is like the desire for activity, doing, you know, this kind of kamaloka, where you want to just do stuff, you know. So it can be very hard, especially as males, to not do, to be powerless in a way, and to where you know you could do it, but you have to calm that impulse to do something. And just to stay with the practice, stay plowing your little field, going up and down, up and down, up and down, the same walking path, or, you know, staying within the boundaries of the forest. And instead, you could be out there, world teacher, great hero. And no, the right thing to do is to conquer yourself. When asked about one who is unshakable, So these are the qualities of one who's unshakable, is that they're equanimous, and they see things as they really are. They're neither bitter, nor are they indulging in calm and peaceful states of mind. You know, they could do a lot of things in the world, but they actively choose not to, so that they can uproot this dart of suffering and extinguish the desire for rebirth. Okay, so that's just that one. You have anything to say about it?
Yeah, it is that if one person is calmed down, and if he's asked, what are the benefits of your meditation? What are the benefits of your calm down? Not the calm down, as an unshakable person, unshaken person. The first verse, it says four characters. Now it's a troubled situation, but the people see the Buddha is in between the river, he's calmed down. And someone come and ask, this part is father, this part is father. What is your benefit, and but how do you manage? The Buddha says first, anittu, I will see there. Anitturi, ananugidho, anadho, anajo sabbadi samo, tamanisansam prabhumi, puchito avikampanam. Unshaken person, if someone is asked, what is the benefits of your meditation? What is the benefit of your monk's life? What is the benefit of the sati? He says, anitturi, I am not envious about anyone. They are high, I am low, or whatever it may be, no envious, anituri, ananugiddho. He says, I am not attached to anything, or I am not crazy, I am not chasing behind something. There are things, basic needs, as he tried to mention, but not, this is the brand, this is the quantity, this is the way I read. No, ananugiddho, anejo sabbadi, no having any kind of a desire. Unless your maintenance, unless you are sustaining. And the last one is samo. For both the parties are the equal. He says that these are the four benefits I can share with the non-meditators. I can share with, through language. I can share with communication. And not that superhuman powers. All are human qualities. If someone is asked, unshaken person, or meditator, or mendicant, these are the four things. Many people attribute the superhuman powers to the Buddha, superhuman powers to the Dhamma, superhuman powers to the Sangha. No, they are human. They are not jealous about anything. No irsha. There is no, I must have that brand, I must have that quantity, I must have it from that maid. No. There is no such. No gij, no trushna. That means you have your basic needs. You are not beyond that. But you are not accumulating and not envious about having them to the others and kind of nothing. And samo. With the mother party, mother's thing going to win or father's party going to win? Nothing. So these things, all four, you have in children. Before 6 years old, it is not so serious, so deep, and so, complicated. We were there. And our parents misled us. Our teachers misled us. Our religious masters misled us, saying, this is good, this is bad, this is auspicious, this is not auspicious, this is justifiable, this is not justifiable. Ultimately, these scripts are working in our mind, so we can't get rid of them. When the mother and father are going to fight, there's nothing good and bad you can take as a yardstick. You have to go back to the child age. I don't care. I am not jealous about as a young people. And I have no brand. I have no quantity. I have no maid. Anything. And I have no desire. As far as the mother is there, father is there, they will take care about me. I have no fear about the nudity. I have no fear about the future. And samo, if you have enough food, start singing and playing, finished. If there is not enough food, cry. Babuge bale, andano bale. So by crying, you get everything. So now, after 6 years, we started corruption. And 20 years, then onward, you are spending time for education, so-called shit. Can't help. So they are necessary things. But as he tried to mention, this all the facilities, Silicon Valley, IT, everything is a cancer in the human mind. They are not answering. They appear like answers. And after that, we work for 30 years, 25 to 55, sometimes 65. And then you get the occupational disease. At the 55, you know the death symptoms. You know your detrimental disease, either contagious diseases or non-contagious, because of bad exposure. You are sitting and tapping. You are not doing sweating. You are not climbing. You are going to the car, to the air-conditioned office and coming back. Or you at home, you are working, only fingertips are working. And then what kind of a thing? This human body is not meant for these fingertips. And that education gives us what we call white-collar jobs. For me, it is crucification, just like Jesus Christ. You are crucified. And 55, full of fear. You know you are diabetes. You know your blood pressure. You have cholesterol. I mean modern diseases. And then everything you earn is for the medical insurance. One disease is enough for the whole family dowry, properties. Because medical science is a mercenary. They are exploiting this. And without such a insurance, you can't live in the West. And they have so much of a fear if a disease happens. No, now this, I don't know, this monk, I am calling that the Irish, is very happy to go to Sri Lankan government hospital. But you feel humanity. They are giving completely free, specifically for the monks and kind of, they give the best. But myself, I am happy to go to the private hospital. Because it's a posh, it's a luxury. You have to pay bill in five numbers or something like that. So people say it is very bad to go to the government hospital because it is for the poor man's job. You are a prestigious monk. All the well-to-do monks, they are going to the private hospital. They never think about Ayurveda, the herbal medicine. So we, on 15th, I will just now give the message, and we are going to have the complete Ayurveda treatment, the spa. That means steaming and herbal bathing, massaging, oil massage. A team will come and 30-40 monks will go and get the treatment, everything free. The monks are not happy about that. Today the allopathic medicine, no medicine, doctors are on strike, everything. And so much people go and find fault with the government. But the Ayurvedic minister, he says, no one is coming to the Ayurveda hospital. Government never send, if this allopathic hospital is house full or no medicine, why don't you go there? Then I told, why you are fighting for that? Because medicines are free. It's from the herbs. Prepare and treat them. And then the people one day will change their mind. They can do themselves, and their doctors are at home, and you can do anything at home. Hardly you have to have the residential retreat, medicine. They are coming now. That's also placebo. The Buddha mentioned only one medicine, your urine, self-urine. That's the only medicine Buddha mentioned. Of course, other Besa Jakkandak. Yeah, Mahirbalan. That's Besa Jakkandak. That's one book. Mahirbalan is one third. It's only for the Vapit Sim, only one. Nelli, Rasakinda, Aralu. It's a triad. That's for the whole kind of thing. So, this is how a forest monk. Find these things. If the daiga come and offer, it's okay. But your own medicine, your own urine, with you. And the Buddha used to the last drop. when he was a layperson, when he was before enlightenment. And he has eaten to his shit, to the last drop, in the Chula Singhanada Sutta. It's not literal to read it. Buddha to be in the 7 years, 6 years, he used only these things. Then he says, nothing to worry, darling, I have done it for you. Do it. But mind you, the mind is the matter. If you are healthy, mind, anything ready. So likewise, that being a monk in the forest, of course, this is not a forest. This is more than a village. We have all the facilities. People are still happy. But you must understand frugality. You must understand how to say enough. And there are a lot of people in need. You can share with them. Ayurveda is the best way. Mindfulness is the best way, free of charge. You can ask them to come. They are not coming. They are happy to go to America and get a scholarship. Go to Oxford and get a scholarship. This is Oxford, the degree holder. But they don't have mindfulness. They don't understand the herbal qualities of the trees. But they have done with extracts. And because extracts need no any kind of a behavioral thing. You have to swallow one or two tablets and sleep. That's all. So what a kind of deprivation of the humanity. So this one, the Buddha was pressed against the wall. So he reflect himself. Four qualities. He can tell others, I am not jealous. I have no brand. I have no desire. Whether losing or gaining, justifiable or unjustifiable, dhamma or adhamma, I am equal. That is the point where you lose ethical values. You lose the culture. To come up to that, you must have ethics. You must have the restraint. But now, whether you are successful in restraint, moral restraint, concentration restraint, and the prajna restraint, vipassana, no harm. Is it go loeb? And again it will come. So therefore, and the other one is, anijasa vijanato nattikachi nisankati viratoso viyaramha khemang pasati sabbadi. For that kind of a person, he will never do volitional thing. He will never do willful thing because he let the thing to happen. That is called Taoism. No will. No wish. No aims. No determination. Just let the thing to happen. You just adopt into the thing. Kisi sanskar ek nata. No will. No volition. If someone come and ask, Bhante, can you do it? He says, Yutu haki ruchi. I have to first say, as a monk, is it should or shouldn't? Do or do's? Don'ts or do's or don'ts? He can come and tell me. Then I say, I'm sorry, I'm a monk. I can't. Say, it is within my capacity, yes. Then he has to say, is it within my jurisdiction? Do you have enough skill and the skill? Equipments? Then he says, yes, I accept your this thing, because it is within the monk's life. Equipments also there. And he also come and say, three people come, it is justifiable, it's a do's, and I have equipments and the skill, but do what you like. Not depending on him, or him, or him. Yutu, haki, ruchi. Then 80% successful. Because you do something you like. It is not to your will. He suggested a lot of suggestions. That is not your initiative. You never initiate anything. So that is, no, sankhara is not there. And you must understand, daily we are chanting, sabbe sankhara dukkha. Abbe sankhara anicca. Whatever you do willfully, dukkha. Creating a turmoil. Creating unwanted whirlpool. Sabbe sankhara anicca. Whatever you do, it will become otherwise. Sabbe dhamma anatta. And that is this thing. Sanskara gentaruvi hamtanni kheme dakkinavi. As far as you are not willfully doing, always you are at peace. I did it because he asked me. I found it is do's, not don'ts. I found I can do within myself, I have equipments and I have capacity. Then, on top of that, this is my wish. I am happy, this is my hobby. Thank you, I do it. With the failure or success, I initiated not. He initiated, I appreciated, I seconded. 100% success. So at least 80% we call comfort zone. We call least frictional path. So present day, people are decided by money. You can't wash and clean. But let them happen. When you are going there, so much of people, deprived people come and say, Bhante, shall we do this, shall we do that? Everything. No one you reject. Everything you let them, let the suggestions to happen, you to haki ruchi. Then you see you are riding the wave. You are beyond the ball, but you are not succumb to the ball. You are not inundated by the wave. So this is how gliding can happen. That's called beyond the ball. And that's also a phrase from Upandita Sayadaw. The last one, the samesu na omesu na ussesu vadati muni santoso vita machero nadeti nirasati. Such a enlightened being or a understood person, he never compare other people as me. He's equal like me. Oh, he never compare, he is superior to me. Oh, I am superior to him. All these things are called mana. That is because of language. That is because of language. In a birds and living in a flock together, so they are living. There is no language. I mean, leader is maybe. But commanding, demanding powers, everything is language. Whenever people come together, only one person, no language. Two people means language and the social order, then start discrimination, comparison. And that is why we became monk. That is why we wanted to be enlightened. That's also a comparison. At the beginning, that is the motivation. But at the end of the meditation is your motivation will be destroyed. So this is what it happened, that's why we cry. My meditation is a failure, my mindfulness is a failure, my sati concentration is a failure, my object is a failure, because you don't like. You don't like the failure. But it's a very good sign, you are losing your ego, temporary. So therefore, not high, not equal, not low. He do not have the internal defilements, we don't have not transparent character, is transparent. He will never take success or failure as a permanent thing. Not auspicious, not unauspicious, therefore he do not accept, he do not reject. This is the basic, this last sentence is the basic we are teaching, the bare attention. These are the characteristics of mindfulness, choiceless awareness. And that made me a big change in my life. I learned it in Nilambe, and that word coined by Ken Wilber in the book called No Boundary. And there onward I found that is by practicing mindfulness, you are already enlightened. There is nothing to enlighten. Whatever happened can make no difference to you. Of course, sometimes it happened temporarily, shaky, but later you know they are also going to end up with peace. So I have to, sorry to say, I have to wind up the meeting. Thank you very much for the participation.